Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Robin McKean, and all the hosts for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics, right here on Blog Talk Radio.
Forest, a safe place where we have the freedom to think about life without judgment. We take a look at society, we examine it, and we allow for the possibility of something new, something different. And now, here's your host, Alan Ritter.
Well, welcome everybody to this October the 1st show of episode 2017 of An Emerging Forest. And it's very interesting that this was bound to happen. I had people scheduled to be on, and they are not present yet. So I will ad-lib and talk about other things until they show up, and hopefully they'll show up. Sent them off an email, you know, saying, by the way, why didn't you call this phone number? But we'll see if they show up. Luckily, I have things to talk about. You know, without their content, I have my own content because I was offered a farming job that I worked on Friday and Saturday before last week's episode. Last week's episode is a really great episode about the Ahimsa House. I recommend that you go listen to that one. That's a really great episode about the gifting economy and the things that are going on in that alternative economic and teaching platform in West Philadelphia. So I also worked on the farming job Monday to Saturday this week, and it's really interesting. It involves a drastic change in my personal schedule, getting up prior to 4 a.m. in order to be on the road by 5 a.m. in order to have a semi-relaxed, quote-unquote, breakfast and making sure that I have all of the things that I need. And then a medium length public transit commute. And the friend who actually found this job for me on the main line offers her car at various days for me to get in and to get out. Or on other days, I actually walk. I think it's almost 2 miles into the farm and then walk almost 2 miles back out to the bus stop and snag the bus and come back on out. But the full-on walk-in, walk-out hasn't happened more than once, I think. I get help on one of the legs, either from the farmer helping me to get to the bus stop or from my friend either dropping me off or just full on loaning me her car. So this is a small place that I've been working on in Berwyn, PA. It actually is a farm that mostly is concentrated on alpacas and chickens. It's a pretty small farm. It's not any acreage to say that it's got acreage, but it certainly is to my eyeball a lot of land, a lot of what I look at as gardening area, whereas farmers would say, oh, that's really not that much land to grow stuff on. But I'm just looking at it from the perspective of the structures that are on it and the land and the swale water management systems that could be implemented. But let me take a step backwards and sort of give you a summary of what I've been doing. So I get there at about 6:40 in the morning, and that's in the last week, sort of just after the sun is coming up, after the gray turns into sort of the mellow yellow, as it were, of the early morning. And the sun is like coming straight off of the limb, right down straight into your eyeball if you're turned to look at it, which is problematic walking from A to B. If you're going in that direction with a wheelbarrow, you kind of have to turn your head to the side and hope that the wheelbarrow doesn't go over a big stone, which it invariably seems to do. So I get there and I measure out two containers of alpaca feed because one's going to the girls' area and one's going to the boys' area because they are segregated by sex to avoid breeding. And then up until like the last day, there were some goats in with the girls, and I would separate the goats out because goats shouldn't eat alpaca feed. It's been learned by unfortunate experience that goats bloat up when they eat the alpaca feed. So the goats are bribed with apples or strawberries or something sweet. Especially the young lady goat who doesn't come to greens. The boys come running to greens, but the young lady needs a sweet apple or some other or a strawberry in order to get her to come into the little side area. And then I close the door on them so that the girl alpacas are segregated from the goats, and I go in and I feed the alpacas. And then when I'm done with the girls, I go over and feed the boys. And alpacas are very, they've got this behavior going on where maybe one of the alpacas is sort of the boss alpaca, where it just seems to me that one of them in both areas has this behavior where I'm putting down like a 16-ounce or maybe a 12-ounce tin can filled with pellet farm animal food into dishes or into a longer trough, but mostly into dishes. And this one alpaca will come and greet me and try to stick his nose or her nose into the feed bucket, and then when the feed actually goes down into the first bucket, that alpaca will take two bites or one bite out of the first container and then be right back at my elbow bite, and then right back at my elbow before I even tainter the next tin can to bend down to put it in the next feed bowl. And then, of course, initially trying to put their face back into the bucket, and when they find see that I've got that guarded and it's impossible, they their bite you know of the next bucket, of the next feed bowl that I'm dumping into, so on for about four or five bowls. And for the first couple of days, I thought it was like, oh, okay, you know, something, you know, weird is going on. But not only do I see it from one particular individual in the girls' area, I also see it in one particular individual in the boys' area. So to recap where I'm at, I'm really sorry for all with the audience that's tuned in to hear about Prague and a travelogue from the young lady who was supposed to be on, she would also be talking about the architectural details and its Masonic symbology. She hasn't called in yet. I sent her a reminder email. I haven't had that many guests on all of my programs on this network, but they usually show up. And not only has Janice not shown up, but my co-host, David Whitman, has also not shown up. So I hope they're both doing well. And we'll just continue on, and possibly they'll pop in. But there's really interesting farm stories and farm information to be told. And if I get to go for the full hour, maybe I'll go on to other topics. But it's been at least several weeks since I've done a solo program, and frankly, quite a lot has happened in my life. So I've got a lot of interesting tidbits to talk about. And as always, this is a call-in program for everyone. And the number is 646-564-9714. So back to alpacas. So after I get done feeding the alpacas, I look and see how the quality of their hay is, and if their hay is if it's been picked over, it has the consistency of thicker straw or thicker hay, and they've actually picked off all the stuff that they would choose to eat. And at that point, it needs to be replaced, a new bale with finer material on it that they would actually enjoy eating needs to be placed. So that's another detail. And also, their water needs to be checked, and mostly they need water. Now, that's been interesting because in the earlier 3 or 4 days of the total, I think about 8 days that I've worked, it was still very, very warm. It was unseasonably warm getting toward the end of September. But on about Thursday morning, the temperature was more seasonable. And since Thursday, Friday, Saturday that I worked, they haven't used the water as much. And, of course, that's well understood that they haven't used the water because, just like me, I can work a full shift of 3 hours and hardly take a sip of water. Whereas if it was, 88 or something degrees, I would be stopping every 45 minutes or so to actually have a 5-minute sit and drink like a half a liter or 2/3 of a liter of water and then get up and get moving again. So after I finish, assessing the feed situation of the alpacas, there were some roosters down in the lower area on this farm, and I was feeding them, but they've been moved off to new owners. And so the other larger group of animals that I take care of is a small flock of chickens. but usually there's some cooked food that's going up to the chickens and it needs to cool down. So the schedule, if the chicken food is ready early, I can go up with the chicken food as long as it's been given like 45 minutes to an hour to cool. But usually I'm there and the food needs to cool. So the next thing I do is clean up the areas where the alpacas roam and clean up the areas where the lower rooster and the lower roosters and the one rabbit that's down in the lower area live in. So I'm talking lower and higher. And what do I mean by lower and higher? Sort of geographically, as you come off the road to the left, you've got the barn, and to the right, you have a farmhouse. And in the initial barn, it's a sort of a probably a two-story initial barn, and then it connects over to another barn. And I'm going to take a short break, a one-minute break, and I'll be back. Talk to you in a minute.
There is one power in the universe, and we are perfect manifestations of that power.
And as such, we pray. We pray for peace. We pray for love. We pray for stability. We pray for the nation in which we live. We pray for the world.
We will it. We manifest it. We draw it to us. We receive it. We accept it. And we give thanks for it. And by our will, so mote it be.
Thanks for listening to that prayer. Actually, David Whitman has called in, and he's going to go call Janice and see what's going on over there. But in the meantime, so the lower barn is a set of structures. It's actually a smaller barn with stalls and storage, and then that hooks up to a sort of what I would call a classic small dairy barn. And that classic small dairy barn, the whole thing, the right and the farmhouse on the right and the barn structures on the left are on a hill with a driveway going up the middle. And the driveway curls up to the left and then ends up curling out to the right on top of the hill, but that's up a ways. But the interesting thing about such a structure, such a hill and such a barn in that location, is classically farmers have taken advantage of being on a hill in order to be able to place their hay into a hayloft. And how they do that is they actually build out, they build a dirt footing behind the barn. So the barn is raised up and there's a hill behind the barn, and the farmers build toward having a bridge between a pier structure, which is walled on three sides. And they drive their tractor up the edge of this pier, and then what they need is a boxed bridge. And they build that boxed bridge, and that boxed bridge actually goes between the pier that they've built with stone on three sides and the hill on the fourth side. And then they go over this bridge, and they actually wind up with their tractor being able to haul very large loads of hay onto the third floor of their barn. So this barn actually has three stories and an attic or a crawl space or a trust area above. It's very interesting because to me it's a large space, but I've been on dairy farms before, and it's kind of not a very large dairy farm or a very large dairy barn. It's kind of a pretty small dairy barn. And it's interesting, just the structure, just being in this environment after having been in an urban environment and sort of returning to this set of tasks and these rustic chores that I've certainly done, that I certainly have experience with, but not this much experience. And to be in this environment where you walk up the road, up their driveway, up past the back entryway to the barn, past the house that's up on the hill, and over to the chicken coop, just that whole walk to me is idyllic. It's such a contrast to passing to working in acting in New York City, and then being in the suburbia just east of Camden, New Jersey, that I live in, being in that environment. It's such a massive contrast and such a huge difference in vibration, in air quality, in feel, in life pulse. And it's really that contrast is really incredible, when especially on the days when I walk out. So I finish my shift and I'm ready to leave, and I walk out 2 miles and get to the bus and get on the bus, and literally getting on the bus coming back toward 69th Street from a location almost like Ridley Creek State Park, Route 3 and Providence Road. It's really interesting to feel the being in the country, but having walked out of more rural country down to an intersection with a few buildings, but then literally 5 or 7 minutes later on the bus to be back in to this asphalt buildings on both sides. So I'm going to take, actually, that's not a bad idea. So I'm going to actually take the bottom of the hour break right now. So please enjoy listening to Darv the Bard, Green and Gray.
around the 1st of May. A man in black came walking into a wooden glade, following the sounds of pipes on this beautiful spring day, high from the music that they made. But what beheld him within that place? A look of recognition fell across his face. Oh Lucifer, oh Lucifer, why do you appear to me? For I am a man of God, a priest. I'm no devil.
Green and gray. tune in to International Pagan Radio. You can hear your favorite artists such as Dave the Bard, Tuatha Dea, Spiral Rhythm, S.J. Tucker, Murphy's Midnight Rounders, and many, many more. Join us for exciting shows like Ask a Witch and Storytime with Rook as well. www.internationalpaganradio.com on the net or on TuneIn Radio on your mobile devices. Join us on Facebook and Twitter too. International Pagan Radio, all pagan, all the time.
Welcome back to An Emerging Forest on the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. We hope everyone was able to stretch their legs and get a drink. And now, back to Alan.
Well, hello again. I'm joined by David Whitman here for this last segment of the program. Hi, David. How are you this evening?
Hey, Alan. How are you doing?
Pretty good. So I was talking in the first half hour about how I'd been privileged to work on a farm out in the Main Line area and there's several methods that I use to get out there. One of which is like totally public transportation and then getting let off at an intersection and walking in. And that involves walking 2 miles to get to this farm. That's if I don't have a ride. And that hasn't happened very much. Usually the friend who found me this job loans me her car either or drops me off and I only have to sort of fend for myself. But it's really interesting because the vibration of the city and the vibration of the denser areas. But then again,
certainly,
you're from Williamsport. So you also know the vibration of the open spaces that are downtown Williamsport is certainly got a different feel to it, but it's not it's not suburbia in any way, shape, or form, and it certainly isn't a larger metropolitan area. I don't think Philadelphia qualifies as a larger metropolitan area because New York qualifies as a larger metropolitan area. So literally as you walk out, contrast is so interesting because you walk out of these larger farms, maybe 72-acre farms, and that's not really a very large farm, but that's the size of the farms that are in that area of Pennsylvania. And you get to the road, and as you come up to the road, there's a car dealership and a bank and 2 restaurants on the north side of the highway. And you walk across and you get on the bus, but you still have a feeling and an understanding that just, 100 meters up the road, you're back into this wooden horse farm type fencing on both sides, and it's larger properties. It's not dense packed housing, but you get onto the bus, and literally like 5 minutes or 7 minutes later, just riding on the bus, all of a sudden, like Upper Darby appears, and I know I smell horrible coming off of the farm because I sweat and I stink, and I know that I I admit that when I work out, I don't smell very nice. Vibrational cleanliness that you have when you're out in a more sparsely populated area, and then all of a sudden you come back into the densely populated area, but not densely populated with people. It's densely populated with buildings and stores and Kohl's and Lowe's and places like that.
Well, so it's interesting what you're talking about, because I feel that there's a dichotomy there, and you see that in rural areas where you have a lot of farms or a lot of green belts or places to hike and things. And then, a couple miles away, you have the strip center, which is where everyone shops at, with the Kohl's or what have you. It's this separation. You have it in Williamsport as well. You have the separation between the commercial and then the rural, and then the country. And rural and country aren't necessarily the same. I mean, rural could be farms and things like that, maybe some shops, whereas country is when it's just trees and it's places to go hiking or fishing or what have you. So it is a sense where you're more out there in open spaces, but it's also more corporatization as well, because a lot of the mom and shop places just can't survive in those areas.
Right. So how you're using the words when you say rural, that's actually developed in some way, shape, or form. But
not necessarily
when you
developed,
say country,
but a rural area is more. Yeah, rural area is like farms or something, right? It is developed in a sense. The country is just it's trees. It's country, you know.
I've been in the Williamsport area for hiking in particular, and so what you're saying is rural has somebody's fence on it, even if it's a hill,
right.
On the other side of that hill, it's got somebody's fence on it, and it's part of somebody's farm, whereas country is a wild area.
Yeah, exactly.
And there really aren't that many unclaimed areas. But a wild area might be a reserve, or might be a part of one of the trail systems, or something like that. Do you think like everything in those areas is quote unquote owned, or is it some of it is not owned?
In the Williamsport area, there's a few things. One, you have a lot of land that is unincorporated, but still could be owned by a hunting club or different clubs, or just families that have owned that land for years and never developed it. But what happened is when you had the Marcellus shale boom last decade or so, a lot of this land was bought up to do exploration on. And so it became almost where these pristine areas now became places where they put up pads to do fracking and explore the gas reserves that are there. So it changed in the last decade. How much actual land is like unowned by anyone? Probably very little. There's at least probably families that own it, or the state owns it. So I don't know. I mean, I really don't think there's much land that's completely unowned. It's either a family owns it, or a state owns it, or it's in I forget the word is. There's not partnership, but proprietorship or something like that. So even land that is country is either like part of a owned by the government or owned by a family or someone that has some sort of claim on that land. And what they do with the land is, I guess, at that point up to them. But as far as true wild lands, I'm not sure there's much of that around, but I could be wrong. Where do you hike up around there?
The one large area was, there's various trails. There's the Susquehannock Trail System that's sort of west of Williamsport. It's been more than 30 years since I was in the area.
You may have been
so,
out there in the Grand Canyon area, if that's possible.
I don't remember the it's a trail system. I don't know if you know Ole Bull State Park. Does that ring a bell to you at all?
Not necessarily, no.
It's OLEBULL State Park. And I think that was sort of the center of where this sort of donut figure eight trail was. It's an 80-mile loop trail that's actually like connected at the waist, so you can choose to only walk 44 miles if that's more your speed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's I can't remember what the highway number is, but it's got like, it's like 145 or 114 or something like that. But there's a bunch of trails up there. The Chuck Kuiper Trail and the Black Forest Trail and the Susquehannock Trail System that I was discussing before, that I mentioned first, that are all sort of up in that area. And myself and my father went and explored those sort of when I was in my middle to late teenage years, and that would have been sort of the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a while ago, and it's interesting that you're basically saying the whole area is very much undergone a complete change because of the of developers seeing that there was this quote unquote gas resource to be had, right?
Yeah, no, exactly true. There's areas that were definitely affected. Other areas weren't so much, but it was a sense of if I was a person who owned this land and a landman from the oil company who's representing, you know, for this gas exploration comes and says, you know what, here's a check for X amount of money we want to explore on your land. I mean, these people would take in a lot of cases because they needed the money and B, you know, they didn't maybe a lawyer or something to represent them, so they may have got taken. But you know, it was a boom. It was a boom in that area, and it had a huge impact on the economy, of course, for that period of time.
For most of those people, I know when I was in that area, they really didn't have very much money at all, and they were pleased to see my father and I like spend a night in their hotel or buy food at their country store. And like the tourist dollar was very slim, but it was very much appreciated. But there just really wasn't that much cash coming in. So, I mean, unless somebody had the jobs up there are just like any I mean, unless you have like some kind of outside job that's actually put you there, the jobs that are actually stood up in that area are not really going to pay you a whole lot. So the people, and we weren't dealing with those type of people, the people who would have had like some type of quote-unquote paying job. We were dealing with people who were at gas stations and owned the country store or had the little motel where if my dad and I came off the trail and just wanted to spend the night before going back onto the trail, we would, you know, use a room.
Right.
Those were people who were very dependent, and for them to have somebody come to them and say, "Oh, here's $50,000. Will you let us explore on your land?" That would have been a hugely wonderful day in their life.
Oh no, no, that's very true. Exactly. And that's the point. I think that there's so much that that we look at as far as business. Oh, I need to make this money. But a lot of people just have that because, or businesses like that, or because that's all they know. And anyone that shows up, they're happy with. And there's a period of the year when they probably have a lot of people, and period of the year when there's no one there, and they're. That's their livelihood, you know, that's what they do. And it's not necessarily about making a ton of money. It's more or less just acclimating to that area. And how do I make a living here? Because I love the land. I love this area. So what do I do to be able to, to have this, you know, to have this life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you can live a slower life there, and you can live a life that, you know, a little less financially driven because you're living in an area where, things are maybe a little cheaper and just simpler, obviously.
It's also the case, and I saw this a lot when I was living in Vermont, that at some point in the past, there might have been an industry which called the people to be in that area. Then let's just say, for instance, it was 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then that industry went away, but the people stayed because when the industry was there, you know, X number of generations of that family lived in that area, populated the schools. They have psychological roots in that area. But they don't understand, or they're not. They won't pick up the economic mirror and look themselves in the face. They say this is where we live, but the fact was that was where they lived when a certain industry actually originally attracted them to come to that area, and now it's gone.
Well, and that's the Industrial Revolution right there. You pop up the industry, you pop up the industrial, and these people are there working in the factories and making money to live, but they're actually making money for the people that own the factories, and it became almost like their temple and their home because they would spend so many hours there. But that's what it was. Maybe it was a textile factory. Maybe it was a plant. You know, Williamsport had a big lumber industry for decades that carried them. Maybe it was steel. Maybe it was what have you. But and then once, of course, those jobs went overseas or went over to where there was cheaper labor, they disappeared. And that's one of the downfalls of the capitalist society, or in general, the whole idea of a factory mentality. And you had factory towns. You'd have a town where the factory popped up and they'd build these houses and it would all be based around this factory. I think Ohio had that a lot with the rubber industry in particular, or the steel industry in western Pennsylvania. But the point is that it was about a machine. You're feeding the machine, and the machine is the in the industrial building, that whatever you're making there, and then the owners are reaping the benefits, and the workers are there, maybe 60 hours, 80 hour weeks, but they make good livings for that time, and they could retire on that. And it was a different thing. It's fascinating to see these old factories and industrial places becoming like luxury apartments or lofts or art spaces. You have that in Williamsport with textile factory that used to be there, and now it's the pajama factory, and there's art spaces and things, but completely industrial. And the reuse of that is indicative to how the cultural change has evolved. You know, we're leaving the industrial age, and that's a good thing. At the same time, it's repurposing these places for something that's a little more wide-ranging than what they were. You know, these people sweated, toiled, and bled their lives into, has now become a place of more creative endeavors. You know, they're not, you know, these people were probably working in factories and things they did every day. They pounded a hammer into something, or they just worked on a line, and that was what they did. They just had their purpose was doing that. There was no creativity involved. It was like you were a machine, and you had to keep doing these things. And now it's changed to where these places, their purpose is to supply space for creativity. So I think that's an interesting evolution, transformation.
So initially, the farm workers were living wherever they were living and working in the factory.
No, what happened was now the farm workers were farm workers, and then the factory workers, you hire people in the factory, but guess what? It's a pretty big factory. Who's going to be the next people to come in? It's going to be farmers. So you start hiring the farmers away from the farms, but the farmers are used to independent thinking. So they're not used to having, they want to come up, well, wait a minute, this is a better way to do it. No, we want you to do it this way because it's how we do it. So there became this whole thing where you brought people from the farm into industry, and it was, it created a whole other dynamic in the factory world. And, because no longer were these people who were farmers being able to be independent workers or independent to what they were doing. They were part of this larger machine, and they would have to assimilate to that mentality. Don't think out of the box. This is what you do. This is your job. This is what you do. You know, this is your paycheck every 2 weeks or whatever. And, you know, the factory, in some places, those factories would provide grocery stores and clothing stores. You know, the whole factory town just propped up during that time. And a lot of times they did take people from the farm because they paid better. And, you know.
That's interesting that what you're saying is the farmer is basically the independent thinker, and
yes.
Once they lose that ability to, we need to change this, or this needs to move on, or we need to transport ourselves someplace else. Once you have put that spark into a factory life for two or three generations, that's gone, and what you
exactly get
is you get the folks in rural Pennsylvania and in rural Vermont and other places that are similar to that who don't see that the economics of the situation doesn't support their presence, and they're eking out a living, but maybe they should go on walkabout and move off somewhere. Well, unfortunately, David has dropped the call. Maybe he'll call back in, but I'm not sure. So, as always, this is an emerging forest, And this is Sunday night, almost 10 o'clock on October 1st, 2017. And I really encourage everyone to bring fertility into their life. Hi, David. I'm glad you're back.
Yeah, I'm back. So, yeah, let's talk about the worker bee mentality, which is what happens, right? I mean, then you become the worker bee, and you're feeding the hive, so to speak, and you've lost your individuality. You know, is it really much of a leap, the fact that you talk about Vermont, and Vermont's one of the biggest areas for heroin addiction? You know, when you take away people's individuality, what do you expect?
Well, it's interesting that I've been recently I lived for 3 years in Vermont, in northern Vermont, all the way up at the border of Canada. And one of the subcultures that I heard about but did not have any contact with was the massive, massive amount of drug importation. Because it's a border town. I was in the border town of Newport, Vermont. And just across the border in Canada, the rumors or the things that I heard was there was a particular strain or a particular a quality level of marijuana that was causing a lot of people in that area. I mean, here's this thing. Well, I can't eat. I can't put food on the table for my family. I can't do anything. But here's this thing that I'm going to have to take a risk with. And people, to many people, it's a no-brainer. They don't say, okay, it's time to pull up stakes here in Vermont, because they don't see that the life that brought them there originally has gone, and they might better off flow somewhere else. They have the mentality of, this is where my family has been for X number of generations, and we're going to make, you know, here's quote unquote the family house, and it's been in the family for 5, 6, however many generations. And it's not the case that, okay, the game has run its, the time has run out, the sand has run through through the measuring device on staying in the area. They just say, okay, what are we going to do in order to stay here? So there was a lot of that going on there. And then I hadn't really noticed it until I started noticing it in northern Vermont. But then I went out and I was working in Willits, California, which is north of Santa Rosa. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because you walk around town and there's no industry and there's no economy, but everybody's got ridiculous cars, you know, ridiculously expensive cars.
Right.
And so you find out from talking to a couple people and becoming friends with a couple people that the economy is in pot. And you find out that, some Lithuanian guy who just went to Burning Man and found and is looking to get a job somewhere so that he can either afford a ticket back to Lithuania or he's trying to make it in the United States, is like walking down the street, going into businesses, going up to the people in the businesses and saying things like, do you know anywhere where I can cut a Z-bud? And and just like being brazen about it and saying, do you know if there's any farms? But that's literally
mm-hmm.
what the economy is based on. And when you get
mm-hmm.
an economy like that,
it has
that's
been
based
for decades,
on,
I'm sure.
Right. When you get an economy like that, that's based on an illegal crop, nobody in town is going to call the police when there's a problem.
No.
No,
they because
can't.
It's, the underground economy. The underground economy will always find a way to thrive. Because people
yeah.
will find a way to
so,
make a living. I mean, that's one of the basis of existence. It's survival. And you make a living to what
right.
you have. You have three choices. You either are part of the system, you just drop out of the system, or you find your own system. I mean, that's really it.
Right.
You know? You either the government right. takes care of you, you work a regular job or what have you, or you work in, or you find something in the underground economy.
Or you become an actor, right?
I think that's part of the underground economy, isn't it? A little bit.
Yeah, right.
A little mix there. But no, I mean, it's just, you know, there's a great song by Steve Earle called Copperhead Road, and it tells a great story. You know, it talks about a family in the South. They started as bootleggers, and then the next generation or two generations come along, and they discover, hey, we can make money growing marijuana. So that's the next step. So they go from the family goes from bootlegging to, you know, to growing hemp, marijuana. Which is only like legal because of the efforts of William Randolph Hearst and I forget who else, but in the early 20th century, because Hearst had his interest in paper to be for trees to be to provide paper.
And it's actually interesting that back in those days, the quote-unquote medicinal qualities of hemp wasn't what was being exploited.
No,
it was only through his propaganda against the sort of the fringe of marijuana's culture that it was actually made popular to use marijuana in
that
way.
A lot of that fringe were jazz musicians who were often African American. So there's another aspect of why marijuana is illegal. I mean, let's face it, many musicians use controlled substances, you know, as part of what they do, as far as, you know, for performance or what have you. I mean, it's a state of fact. We all know musicians, we know famous musicians, non-famous musicians. It's part of the, you know, creative mind to go outside of itself in some way.
Yeah, there's a level of the popularization of drug use through by entertainers that I have to question as being part of how entertainers are marketed and how that sphere of our culture is marketed to be cool to or be interesting or be attractive to the, you know, to whoever it's being appealed to as being, you know, oh, you should be like this. You should do this activity. So, because of the way this whole culture is built through making something alluring and making it a little bit expensive and making it be an achievement that you can – right, or illegal, but making the BMW a status symbol, making meat something only royalty can have unless you're very wealthy or something like that. Those things begin to have an allure and people, quote-unquote, overlook the downside or the downside isn't advertised. So when there's a connection between entertainment folks and just about any other habit, I tend to look at it as a story that's being, as a behavioral modification enticement, sort of. So if people want to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Can be emailed at dwhitman0906@gmail.com. That's really the easiest way at this point. And
okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really trying to think. I mean, yeah, that's the easiest way to get a hold of me.
All right, well, my name is Alan Ritter, and what?
I was joking. I said, send your love and hate mail.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
My name is Alan Ritter, and my email address is RITTER.ALAN88@gmail.com, and this is the end of the October 1st, 2017, and Emerging Forest. Thank you so much for listening, and find the closer one of these times. Have a good week.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks for listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Join us 7 nights a week for exciting programming covering a variety of expressions of faith. And remember, all manifestations of the divine are equally valid.